So I used this talk title once before, and I actually then got a question before I even started the talk, which was, do I have any kids? And the answer to that is no, which maybe leads to the next question is, what does this title mean? And what do the 10-year-olds have to do with quantum mechanics? So the short answer to that is they have nothing to do with quantum mechanics. I'm just using cute kids cynically, or at least cute hypothetical kids, to get you interested in the talk in the first place. There is a longer answer, though, which is that they have, right, well, they're also incredibly hypothetical. There is some connection, not to quantum mechanics, but to the way I'd like to have you think about it, which is that, well, quantum mechanics really takes place at the realm of atoms and photons and really very, very small objects. And the rules of quantum mechanics are very alien to our everyday experience. So the types of quantum phenomena that we can see in the lab are really very surprising and unintuitive to most people. And I would suggest the reason for that is because they're unfamiliar, that we don't see these in everyday life. And the way we get some kind of sense of regular classical physics is by experiencing it. You know, when we drop something, it falls, right? So that's you get an intuitive experience of gravity. And of course, doing that, you get a lot of misconceptions, which it's your job to straighten out in the high school students. But in quantum mechanics, you don't even have the basic ideas to draw on. And so the behaviors of things are very alien. And so I can imagine that if you know you had, as a child, quantum objects to manipulate with, to play with, you'd do one thing, and you'd see what happened. And that would get you some intuitive sense of the way quantum mechanics works. And so that's kind of the way I'd like to talk about it today, rather than going into the mathematical equations that describe quantum mechanics, which of course we have and can predict everything that happens in mathematical detail. I'd like to talk about it kind of phenomenologically, that we do one thing, here's what happens. We do something else, here's what happens to that. And then by building up a number of such experiments, maybe you can start to develop some intuition for the way quantum mechanics works, which, of course, is going to be very different from your experience of classical physics. OK? So I should maybe add that because it's a Blackboard talk, it's very flexible as to how I do this. And I could talk for hours and hours and hours. Of course, I don't have that much time. Or I could talk for a short amount of time and answer a lot of questions, which I'd prefer to do. So if you ask questions during, that's fine. I'll try to finish maybe a little early so we can, or even a lot early, so we can have time for more questions after. But I mean, I can start by asking if there are any questions to start with. Okay. Since everybody answered whether I had kids. Okay. So to start, I'd like to start with something that doesn't seem connected at all, which is with music. And I'm afraid there's no audio aids here. It's purely theoretical discussion. And specifically, I want to talk about digital music. Of course, digital music is a very big deal nowadays. You can download songs off the internet. And the music companies, the record companies, well, they don't mind if you download songs off the internet so long as you pay for them. But of course, what they don't want you to do is download them and then make a copy and give it to all your friends, because then they don't get paid for these copies. And so, of course, the thing they like to do is put in kind of software controls to make it difficult for you to copy. But if you follow the news at all, you'll find that these things never work for very long and never work very well. Okay? And you might think, well, they're just not good enough copy protection schemes. Maybe there's something better out there that they haven't thought of yet. And sooner or later, they'll be able to crack this and prevent people from copying things. But if you think about it a little more carefully, you'll see that that's really not possible. And in fact, the ability to be copied is just a fundamental property of information. And the music that we're talking about, as you can see in the case of digital music, is just purely information. Right? It's information about a series of notes and maybe some more detailed information about the timbre and the duration and stuff like that of all of these notes in the musical composition. The information is stored in some medium. It's on your hard drive, for instance, as a series of magnetic things, or on a CD as a bunch of indentations. And by looking at that physical medium, in the worst case, you can see where those magnetic domains are, where the little holes are in the CD, and copy them to another such storage device, or maybe a different one. You can copy them from the CD to a hard drive. And you can imagine that even beyond that, I mean, even if you didn't have access to the storage device, well, the point of this music is to be played and to be listened to, right? And once it's played, you're hearing it. And when you hear it, you can make a recording, of course, of the same thing. And you might imagine, well, it's not going to be as good a recording because there'll be some loss of fidelity as it gets transmitted. But of course, if you had really, really good, you know, speakers and really good recorder and, you know, good soundproof room, it would be a very, very accurate recording. You could make it arbitrarily good that way. And again, this is just a property of the information. In fact, the very fact that you're listening to it and remembering it, but could still play it again, means that you're making a copy, right? So this is, again, a fundamental property of information. It can be copied. Let's imagine, though, that there was some type of information that didn't have that property, right, that could not be copied, okay? And again, talking about music, we'll simplify and just think about one musical note. And this one musical note will only have two properties that we'll worry about to start with. So one of them is going to be the duration. And that could be either long or short. And the other will be the frequency, which is going to be either high or low. Okay? So we have one note has these two properties. And we'd like to imagine, again, that it can't be copied. So what does that mean? What does that tell us about this? What else does it tell us about this note? Well, for instance, if you could listen to it and say, oh, it's long or short, or oh, it's high or low, and you could do both of those. So suppose you found that the note was short and high. Well, then you could make another note that was also short and also high. And that would be a copy. And again, if you get any combination of these, once you know them both, you can make a copy of that note. So in other words, since we're assuming that it's not possible to make a copy, well, that implies we shouldn't be able to get both pieces of information about this note. Okay? This goes the other way, too. So we can say, well, suppose we could make a copy of the note. Okay, so in order for these properties to have some kind of meaning, we should at least be able to learn one of them, right? We should be able to listen to the duration and say, oh, that was a long note. Or listen to the frequency and say, oh, that was a high note. But the assumption here is that since we can't learn both properties, somehow we can't pay attention to them both at the same time. We can only do one of those, ask one of those two questions. But on the other hand, if we could make a copy, well, then we can take one copy of the note and listen whether it's high or low, and take the other copy of the note and listen to whether it's short or long. So in that case, you could learn both properties. Okay? So you may have inferred by now that this is not really about musical notes. This is a lead-in to talk about quantum mechanics. And the reason is that there is such a type of information that exists, information that has exactly these kinds of properties. And that's called quantum information. And so if you have a quantum object and you store information, what you think of as maybe information on a quantum object, it starts to get new properties. And one of them is that it can't be copied. So that's called the no cloning theorem. Okay, so one of the basic properties of quantum information is that it can't be copied. And a very closely related property that I've also alluded to up here is that when you have a piece of quantum information, you can't learn everything about that piece of quantum information. Because you can answer some yes-no questions about it, maybe, but there's all a large set of yes-no questions, and the answers to them are mutually incompatible. And that, of course, is basically the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So for instance, with a quantum object, you can't learn its position and momentum at the same time. So in this case, I've made the duration and frequency to be complementary variables, so you can't learn both of those at the same time. Okay? And when we talk about quantum information, well, if we have just a single piece like this, we like to give it a name. So if we have a classical information, that could be either 0 or 1, because I have two possible values. That's a bit, short for binary digit. And so quantum information, that's a quantum bit, or qubit. So a single qubit is going to have two values for some basic properties. In this case, duration and frequency. But you could have multiple qubits, which could store more information. And then if you measured one thing, so for instance, you could have two quantum notes like this. And so the first one could have a long duration, the second one a short duration, or any such combination. OK? OK, any questions yet? OK. I don't know if that's a good sign or a bad sign.
We had good reading.
Huh?
We had good reading.
Yeah, good reading. Yeah, OK. So you've encountered quantum mechanics before.
All right, you're spelling with qubit. There's a bit of a controversy with Merman. You've taken the in-between route. He does capital Q dash bit.
Yes, he does.
And everywhere else is going small q, all the one word. What is your stand on this? You can see
No, no. So the proper one, the one that's used by the vast majority of people, is QU.
Yeah.
And I have just capitalized it because, you know, it's the first in a sentence. It's not really a sentence.
Okay, so you're not giving a nod to
No, no. Okay. So in the middle of the sentence is small q, it's the first start of sentence is big Q. But the U, Merman is basically the only one that uses dash. I mean, back 15 years ago, maybe there was some controversy about the spelling, but not anymore. Okay. Right, so maybe let's talk a little bit more about how these things work out in practice, which I guess may still be covering familiar ground for you. No? Well, okay, well, you'll see what I'm doing. Then you can tell me whether it's familiar or not. Okay, so again, so I want to say that when we ask one of these questions, like what is the duration, we get an answer, right? It's either long or short. But we can't both ask what is the duration and what is the frequency on the same note. So how does that work out? So suppose, for instance, that we try that. We would ask first, what is the duration? OK. And then second, ask, what is the frequency? So every time we ask these questions, we should be getting some answer. So it seems like this should be giving us some consistent answer that tells us what both of these properties are. Suppose we get, I don't know, high the first time. Oh, sorry, wrong way around. We get short the first time and high the second time. So doesn't this tell us that this is a short and high note? Well, the answer is no, it doesn't. Because suppose then we were to ask duration again. Now the answer we get is random. Asking about the frequency has erased this kind of information about the duration. So sometimes we might get short again, of course, half the time. But we might get long. Okay? So that's why asking these two questions really doesn't tell you both things. Because it's not just that the information is there. It's just we can only extract a little bit. It's that the state actually is not really well defined in both properties. It can have a definite duration. It can have a definite frequency, but it can't have both definite at the same time. Yeah?
Random and it just happened to come on as pi?
That's right. That's right. So So I was maybe revealing in the sequence of what you saw. And if you do this many times, you'll get, suppose you prepare it so it's always short the first time, which you can do. Then the second time will be run. So sometimes it's too high, sometimes it's too low. Yeah.
So if I do answer question number one, duration is short, do I say I now have 1 qubit of information?
So just by knowing that it was short or long, you don't really know if it's a qubit or a classical bit, right? It could just be a classical bit that's storing it short or long. So to actually know that you have a qubit, you have to see some more advanced quantum objects. So this is a kind of a more experimental question that when they're building devices, they say, well, you know, we'd like to say this is a qubit that we're building, but how do they know it's really a qubit and not just a classical bit? So that's I probably won't discuss that, but we'll get into some more quantum properties later that can help. Yeah.
Just a little clarification of the randomness. So after we did that first test, duration got short. If instead of testing frequency, if we test a duration again,
right? Suppose we were to do this. So we start asking the duration, and we get short, and we ask the duration again.
Yeah.
That's the question. And the answer is yes, we get short again. So this is what it means to say that you can have a well-defined property, that if it's short to start with, it'll stay short, as long as you keep asking about the duration. Now, of course, you could do something else to it, right? You could take it short, and then you could kind of shake it up a bit, and then it might be something different. But at least this means that it can have a definite property for each of these, a definite value for each of these properties, for duration and for frequency. And simply, you could have a state where it started with a certain frequency, and it stayed that way as long as you kept asking about frequency. Okay? So that's why it really makes sense to say that these are properties rather than just random things that happen each time you make a measure. But the fact that they're incompatible is because if you measure one of them, it destroys the information stored about the other one. Okay? Other questions? Okay. So going further, we can actually, when we talk about these things, we don't have to have definite values. We can have states that are not a definite value for duration or for the frequency. And we like to refer to these as superposition states. And for superpositions, when you measure the duration or the frequency, well, you're still going to get an answer, either short or long, high or low. Okay? But the probabilities of getting them might not be equal. So in this case, if you measured duration, frequency, duration, the duration here that you're getting is 50% short and 50% long. But you could have a state that you prepared with to start that had a different balance between the two. So for instance, you could have a state that's 25% short and 75% long, or similarly one that's 25% high and 75% low. But there's got to be some trade-off between these two, right? So you can't have something that's almost always short and almost always high. In fact, the more definite one of these is, the less definite the other one has to be. And that's, again, manifestation, a more mathematical formulation you can make of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Okay, so we get one of these things that we claim is in a superposition.
Yeah.
And then we say, what's the duration? It says short.
Yeah.
Next time we measure duration, it's still short.
For the same note, that's right.
So how do we know it was in a superposition and not in a pure state?
Good question. Right, so a little bit of terminology, actually. Superpositions, so in quantum mechanics, there's pure states and there's mixed states. So a superposition is actually still considered a pure state, even though when you measure it, it's random. So maybe I could say a little bit more about that in a bit. But that's a sideline from this, the main question. And the answer is that, well, you prepare this in a certain way, okay? And the preparation tells you, I mean, it's supposed to create a certain kind of state. And if you always do the same preparation, you should always get the same state, assuming it's a pure state in the technical sense. And that means that when you measure it, so you should prepare multiple copies of the state. So it's allowed, you're allowed to prepare multiple copies of the state because you know how you prepared it. You have classical information about how you prepared it. So you're allowed to make copies of that and do it many times. And when you do that, you can measure each one of them, and then you can get statistics to say, oh, it's 25% short and 75% long.
Can I just have a follow-up question?
Sure.
You said you have classical information that enables you to say this is the same state.
Yeah.
Is that always true? Is that by definition what we mean by preparing the state? We have classical information.
Usually. I mean, when we start to get in the more complicated quantum computation things, you can imagine doing something which says, well, if this one qubit is zero, we'll do this preparation. If the qubit is one, we'll do a different preparation, something like that. And then they become what's called entangled, which I'll say a bit more about later. And so in some way, you can think of those as quantum information about which preparation you did. But another way, it's just a more complicated quantum state. So it's another question. No? Okay. So the thing about superpositions, I mean, the way I've described them is just some probability of one thing versus another. And that's okay for some purposes. And if you measure, you will get this random result. But for other purposes, it's not okay. And the problem is that the regular classical language we talk about things is not really adequate for quantum mechanics. I mean, in some sense, this superposition, the state is either short or long, and you'll find out when you measure it which one it is. But in another sense, it's really both at once. Okay? And I mean, one maybe slight indication of this is that if you think of the high note, okay, that's a state that is equally likely to be short or long. 50% of either one. And if you think of a low note, that's also equally likely to be short or long, 50% of either one. But they're distinct states. They're completely separate, right? If you ask for the frequency rather than duration, you can tell which of these two things you have. Whereas if you ask the duration, you can't. You only get this 50%, 50%, and they look the same. And so that's a sense in which it's both short and long. And kind of the relationship between those, mathematically, it's going to be the phase of the wave function, the relative phase. The mathematical relationship between these is kind of a very important quantum property. And that can maybe better be captured by looking at this complementary variable, even though you're not allowed to look at both of these at the same time. Sorry, I know that wasn't very clear. And again, the problem is that the classical language we're used to is designed is not the right word, but developed to talk about classical objects that we're used to, and it's not good for talking about quantum objects. So this is a constant problem when you're talking about these quantum things. I mean, another way that you can maybe see this problem is you can ask, well, is quantum mechanics discrete or continuous? And I mean, when you talk about quantum jumps, people usually think of that as some discrete thing, right? It's a big jump. It starts one way, then it's a jump, and it's in something else. But quantum mechanics manages somehow to be both discrete and continuous, or maybe it's discrete or continuous, at the same time. And the reason is these superpositions, okay? So this note that I've described to you, this qubit, is a discrete variable, right? It has totally different values, short or long. But at the same time, it's continuous because you can have these probabilities that interpolate between the two. Yeah?
How about visual on this topic? Can you visualize this using the wave packet model so that the width of the wave packet would be an indication of the duration, and the average frequency of the wave packet would be the property of the frequency? So when you have a superposition, you can think of it as a combination of those two within the wave packet?
So by talking about a sound and frequency and duration, I've maybe kind of suggested that idea. So there's a for a single qubit, there's actually a somewhat better visualization. which is actually very mathematically precise visualization, which is called the block sphere. And so the block sphere, well, it's a sphere. And we say that the up is going to be one state, and the down is the opposite state. So for instance, this might be high and low. Okay? And so the north pole is high, the south pole is low. But you also have other variables, like the east pole here can be short, and the west pole is long. Okay? And all the possible states, the pure states, are points on the surface of the sphere. Okay? And if you look at the latitude, that'll tell you the probability of high versus low. Right? It'll tell you how high up on the sphere you are. Okay? And if you look at I guess it's not the longitude, but if you were to take similar vertical slices through the sphere, you'll say how close you are to short or how close you are to long, and that'll tell you the probability of short versus long. And so the superposition states are the ones, well, so the state that's actually on one of these poles is a definite value, and anything that's off the pole is a superposition. And it's maybe worth mentioning at this stage that, of course, the short state itself is a superposition of high versus low. And the low state is a superposition of long and short. So the property of being a superposition is a kind of is a subjective one. It's relative to what you think of as your standard states, called your basis states. Okay? Yeah?
When you take polarizers, then you... Mm-hmm. You put one way, you get one. And then when you put it the other way, you get the other one. When you put it 45 degrees, we had yesterday that you can make a random generator because you don't know exactly. But if you're measuring the same state all the time, you won't get this. You won't get short all the time.
Right.
How does that, so the superposition is different than?
It's not. So it is in this, okay. So the thing is that with light, normally if you have like a laser or just some incandescent light, that's a very powerful light. It's basically a classical light. There's lots and lots and lots of photons. And so what you're not seeing is the individual quantumness of the particles of light, the photons that make up this beam. You're seeing instead the average behavior over many, many such photons. But if you did exactly that experiment with the polarization in a single photon, you would see this kind of behavior. And so it would map the horizontal vertical basis for looking at the polarizer. That would be one of these variables, short versus long. And the diagonal, there's two diagonal bases, right? There's this diagonal and this diagonal, two diagonal states, I should say. So if you looked in that basis, that would be the other variable, say the high versus low. Okay? So if you look at it this way and you do it consistently for a single photon, well, okay, there's a problem, which is that photodetectors usually eat up the photons. So it tries to there's more complicated experiments that actually allow you to do non-demolition measurements of photons, where you can measure its polarization without actually destroying it. But that's much more advanced, and it's very difficult to do. But suppose you could do that on a regular basis. Then if you measure a single photon and send it through a bunch of horizontal polarizers, if it got through the first time, you would get through all of them. And actually, that would be easy to see because you wouldn't see any, you know, kind of decay of amplitude for getting through. Whereas if you did a horizontal vertical and then a diagonal and then another horizontal vertical and then another diagonal, every time you do that, there's a 50% chance it'll get caught. So if you do a couple of these, it won't get very far. Almost certainly. Okay? So with single photons, you would actually see exactly this type of phenomenon. Because single photons are quantum particles, and so they behave in this way. Okay? Let's see. So the other thing that you can see with quantum particles is interference. And I don't think I'm going to talk too much about interference because I don't really know how to explain it very well. But since you all know about classical wave mechanics, say electromagnetic waves, water waves, whatever, you can see interference patterns there. And you can get exactly the same kind of interference with quantum particles, except now it's not interference of, you know, some electric field value. It's interference of a probability. More technically, it's the probability amplitude, which is the square root of the probability, or the probability is the absolute value squared of the amplitude. So you can get probabilities that add up constructively. Or you can get probabilities that subtract. And that's the thing that's different from classical probabilities. Classical probabilities, of course, can add up. But when they add up coherently, because there's a square, they add up faster. And when the quantum probabilities can cancel each other out. So you can have, you know, and that's kind of what's behind the fact that this short versus long, if you have the superposition of short and long, that could either be high or low, depending on exactly how they interfere with each other. So this interference is, again, something that distinguishes you from classical case. And I may talk about some quantum algorithms later on, depending how the time is going. And maybe you'll get some idea of how this works, though probably not very much. There is only a limited amount of time to do all this stuff. And as I said, it's pretty alien. OK, so maybe it's just worth mentioning at this stage. I've said it before. But when you look at very small objects, they actually do behave this way. Individual atoms, individual photons of light, even small molecules can be made to behave with superpositions and display interference. And I guess maybe the getting back to something that was alluded to before, if you have a qubit, how do you know it's really a qubit and not just a classical bit? Well, the signature that people like to look at is, in fact, interference. And so what they do is an experiment called a Rabi oscillation. Let's put that over here. So what they do is they prepare a state which should be a superposition of two things, high versus low. So on this axis, I'll plot. So they take this state and they measure what's the probability of getting high. So to start with, maybe they'll get 100%. Okay, so it's not really a superposition; it's just high. But then they'll do some kind of quantum evolution of this particle that makes it shift between high and low. And so they'll wait some time. And they'll actually be doing this, of course, with not just one but lots and lots of them. And so they'll measure after some time, and after a little bit of time, maybe they get a 50% probability of seeing high. And they wait a little longer, and it's a 0% probability. It's always low. Okay, so this in itself doesn't tell you that it's classical versus quantum. It's the next step, which is where you continue doing this evolution, and you can see it goes back up again. Okay, and that's a signature that you really kept quantum coherence. Because if you didn't do that, well, the probabilities could only subtract. So this could be, well, all these highs are decaying into lows. Right, but then they stay low. It's the fact that you have the balance of high and low that keeps shifting back and forth. And that's an interference effect, basically. Because it's what it's doing, well, it's the quantum phase is changing, really, in the short versus long superposition. Yeah. Sure.
To measure the probability. You actually have to look at some of them. If you've got a very large sample, is that what's happening?
That's right. So you make a preparation of lots and lots of these, and you wait different amounts of time. And you measure a bunch of them at any given time. And so this is a plot of what fraction of those that you see at that time turned out to be high.
But the ones you measured are spoiled, right?
That's right.
You fill those out.
Right? That's right.
Okay.
So you can keep on doing this, and you can see oscillations back and forth. And because it's not perfect, eventually they decay. And it just eventually kind of goes on to a half. And it's just a random state now. But the length of time you do it is kind of a measure of how good you've done at creating this qubit and how long the state can retain its coherence. And I guess you're going to see some nuclear magnetic resonance experiments later this afternoon. And that's one system where they can do a very good job in keeping coherence for a long time. Because in that case, the qubits are individual nuclear spins. So the nucleus can have spin up or spin down. And it's very well isolated from the environment. And that's why it can do this kind of oscillation for a very long time. Of course, what they measure is not precisely this, because they have more limited probes. But I guess I'll let Ray or whoever it is explain that to you this afternoon. Yeah?
Oscillation went away. What did you call that?
I didn't call it, but this is, say, decoherence. Basically, I just said it's because you're not doing this perfectly. Yeah?
So when you get to decoherence, that means that it no longer relates to the original experiment. You could just have grabbed something.
It kind of relates. It depends on exactly what's going on in the system. The most common, one of the very common sorts of decoherence is the loss of phase information. So in that case, you're still kind of retaining the probabilities of high versus low, which is why it gets kind of towards the middle here. But you're losing the information that coherently makes it high versus low. So as you go through this oscillation, you kind of get the average, maybe, of where you are. Yeah.
It's suddenly become very abstract for me.
Yeah.
So you've got to, can you give a simple, concrete example of what you would do to a quantum system to make it oscillate this way?
So one of the classic in the non-classical quantum experiment for this is usually done in atoms. And what you do is you have a single crap atom. And the qubit here is ground state versus excited state of the electron. And it's an atom with, say, one electron in the outer shell. And so it's the energy levels of this electron. And the different energy levels, the phase will process at different rates. That's just the way energy works in quantum mechanics. It changes the phase at different rates. And so if you start with you send a light pulse in. You start with, say, the electron in the ground state. You send a light pulse in. Light pulses can flip it from the ground to the excited state, and vice versa, depending on how long you do it. If you only do it kind of a half wavelength, you'll get into a superposition state.
You mean half the required wavelength?
So actually, let's forget the energy thing. So you just shine the laser on it. And if you do it for just the right amount of time, it'll flip it from ground state to excited state. But it's not a sudden thing. So this is, again, the discrete versus continuous phenomenon. If you shine the laser just for a little bit of time, you'll be, so this will be ground, this will be excited. So you start up here in the Bloch sphere, and you kind of rotate around. Okay, and if you do it for just the right frequency, the right time, you'll end up here at the excited state. And if you do that again, you'll end up back here. But if you do it for half, you'll end up here in the superposition state. And if you do it continuously, you'll rotate around here. Okay? And what this is actually a plot of is basically the latitude, again, the square, really, the latitude, but cosine squared. And so by shining a laser for different amounts of time, you're kind of gradually exciting the atom. But it's excited in a probabilistic sense, so that if you look at it randomly, you'll get this plot at a certain amount of time.
So you'll like get light coming back from it,
I didn't say how you measure the atom, which is again, yes, using a laser, but you can use a different laser that will couple the ground state to some third energy level of this atom that decays very rapidly. And that third energy level, then you can see the light coming out of that. So it's a different frequency that you're seeing. Because you don't want to see the main laser frequency you're using, you won't be able to see that because you're putting this laser in too much light. Okay.
Okay, so when we're teaching, mm-hmm. we get about as far as the photoelectric effect.
Right.
And what you're describing here about this duration seems to contradict what it is in teaching photoelectric effect, where it's one photon and it doesn't So can you help me through that one?
Yeah. So again, this is the dichotomy of discrete versus continuous, which is not really an accurate way of thinking about this. It's kind of both at once. And the way that it actually works is if the photoelectric effect, the kind of discrete step, is whether the photon you're putting in has enough energy to separate the electron from the metal, from the nucleus it's bound. Well, from the metal, yeah, it's not really bound to the nucleus. So that's a step in frequency. But if So if you're finding a laser, I guess you're not really doing this with single photons. You're doing this with lasers, right? And the idea is if you're shining the laser on for a very short amount of time, well, you might not actually knock this electron off, okay? There's some probability of knocking it off. And so if you do it for longer and longer, it'll get off. But it'll only get off with very high probability. The thing is that because the specific setup of the photoelectric effect, it never goes back. Because once the electron escapes, it has lots of places it can go. Okay, so you don't see this kind of oscillation, but it's the duration of how long to shine it is kind of what would determine where along the probability curve you are. Okay. So maybe it's time for something a little more advanced. Let's try.
There's still a threshold energy.
Yeah, there's definitely a threshold energy. And so, so when I was talking about the atom, the frequency of the laser that you shine on to go from the ground to the solid state has to be just right. Basically, it has to be very close. The frequency has to be close to the frequency difference between these two energy levels. The frequency corresponds to energy, right? E equals h nu. So it has to match. And if it's not that, it's off resonance. And you won't transition at all, basically. So for the metal, it has to have just enough energy to knock out, and then it has a continuum of motion. Yeah.
Okay. So let's say we got states 1, 2, and 3. I shine a laser that is able to take it from state 1 to state 3.
Yeah.
State 3 lasts for a very short time.
Right.
Now where does it go? To 2?
Usually it goes back down to the ground state.
Okay. But
it depends on the specific properties of the atom.
The problem is, the reason why you said let's go from 1 to 3 is we don't want to get the same color as the laser because we're drowning out our... Because we're drowning out our reflection.
Right. So I'm not experimental, so I assume that's what I do. There's other reasons, which is that... So the other advantage of doing this 1 to 3 thing is that you can do it again and again and again, which means you're not getting just one photon out, you're getting lots and lots of photons out, which makes it much easier to see.
Is that because 3 happens to be a short duration state?
Yeah, and because it goes back to the ground state, then the same laser that knocked it back up to 3 will do it again. Okay. Whereas
so
the 2 state,
green,
I could...
If it's a green laser, you're still going to get green light out.
So it's going to be the same... Yeah, you're right. So it's the same frequency as this other probe laser. But because you can cycle it many, many times, it's a bright thing. And also, it's coming out in different directions. But if it's just one reflected photon, that would probably be hard to tell. Yeah.
So in case of Rabi oscillations, if it is a lossless cavity, let's assume.
Okay,
so,
that's pretty good.
If you have populated the upper state, let's say, so it should keep on oscillating back and forth between those states.
That's right.
And this particular case is probably showing a lossy cavity, which is where the passage of time decay is taking place. So,
sure. Well, there's other things that can happen, of course, besides loss. You can have some other kinds of junk or oscillations of the cavity, stuff like that.
Of the cavity, So why do we need an additional laser for that? Isn't that enough that the photon that I fully understand the theoretical aspect of it. I'm also a theorist, not inexperienced at this. But why do we need a second laser in order to detect it?
So it depends on the specific system, right? Yeah. So in some systems, you don't necessarily want to do that. So the thing I was talking about was it's not really a cavity experiment. It's the ion trap experiment.
Yeah.
Where you have kind of an electromagnetic bottle that's keeping the atom is usually a group 2 atom, so it has 2 electrons in the outer shell, but it's ionized once. So it has only 1 left, it has a charge of 1. So you can contain it easily in this magnetic bottle. And So in that case, you have this kind of very stable frequency, which is going between two very stable states that themselves don't decay very much. And you do this third state mostly, I think, for the cycling abilities, the fact that it decays very rapidly. So that's why you want it to be a different frequency, really, is to get that property. Because if the other one, it'll just stay there, and you won't be able to see it. In a cavity tree D experiment, you might do it a different way. Yeah?
So is there a specific equation that allows you to determine whether something is in a superposition state based upon its decay duration?
Well, the ideal Rabi oscillation is basically a cosine square pattern. And then as you get it, it gets usually exponentially down. So there's some kind of exponential flow.
That relationship would be
this is a definite signature of quantum behavior. Obviously, you could get something like this mocking it up some other way. But you know, if you're doing everything honestly, usually this is an indication that there's real quantum.
So when something decays quickly from one state like from 3 to 1, you're not probably going to see it.
No, you're not going to see that. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just asking this in a student's point of view because what they will probably ask is, you're saying that you're hitting the atom with a laser and then bring it from one state to the other, and then you're getting the photon from this atom, right?
Right.
Okay. Then why don't you just use the laser itself? Why do you need to heat the atom? They have the same.
Sorry, you use it to measure it? Why do you use the same laser to measure the...
As in, why do you need to heat the atom in the first place? Because you're saying that the light that you get off from the atom is actually the same as the one from the laser?
Right, right. Well, so that's right. So it depends on the specific system. So there are some systems, like these cavity 3D systems, where you can track the light that comes out and then send it back. Okay, so then it would really be the same light that's going back and forth between trapped in this optical cavity, bouncing back and forth in mirrors, and back into the atom. But in the ion trap, you don't have that kind of optical cavity. So the laser is continuously coming in. And the photons that come out just go back into the laser. Okay, but they leave the trap. So it's a different setup. So in some systems, yes, in principle, you can use the same photon over and over again and shuttle it back and forth inside and outside of the atom. But in other systems, it just experimentally, you can't set it up that way. So it's a matter of practical arrangements.
Oh, I think my question is more simple, is that why do we just use the laser? Why do we need this excitation and de-excitation?
Oh, you mean why not just see the oscillations in the laser?
Yeah.
There's a couple of reasons. One of them is we're interested in the atom. We want to know whether we can do coherence in the atom. Another one is it's a little hard to. I mean, lasers are very good for some kinds of quantum things. It's very easy to send them places. Very easy to measure them. It's not so easy to. I mean, you can change them using optical elements, but they don't interact with each other very well. Photons. So there's more limited things you can do with them than with atoms. Whereas atoms, you can manipulate them very well. Yeah.
So now I want to be able to define to my students what is a qubit. I can tell them what a bit is. It's something that's either a 0 or a 1. If I say a qubit, would it be fair to say you're getting two numbers? 0 and 1,
yeah.
0 and 1. But if we know that one of them is 0 or 1, we don't know what the other one is.
Well, kind of. So mathematically, I don't know if this is what you want to say to your students, but mathematically, you can write the state of a qubit like this. So these angle brackets here, you've seen this.
Okay.
These angle brackets indicate a quantum state. The 0 and the 1 are the two basis states. The things that you think of as the classical bit value. And the alpha and beta are the amplitudes. And so the probability of 0 is absolute value alpha squared. The probability of 1 is absolute value beta squared. So you also have that absolute value alpha squared plus absolute value beta squared is equal to 1. And so something that can be in any state like this is a qubit. Oh.
Yeah. What happened to the other... Like, what is high and low?
Right. So this high could be 0. This would be 1. Short here is 0 plus 1 over root 2 for normalization. And long is 0 minus 1 over Richard. So this is the phase, plus versus minus. Okay. And then there's also the front and back poles. Those are 0 plus I, 1.
Ah. Okay. Yes.
And the back one is 0 minus I, 1. Yeah.
I do have children.
So you're an expert.
And they don't come from Krypton. So, what I'm wondering is, you know, when they're still in diapers, they're experimenting with gravity.
Yeah.
They're experimenting with balance, you know, at some stage, you know, 2.5, 3 years old. Where does this journey begin? Could you give me some benchmarks, like the Pauli exclusion principle, or where do we begin? As I begin to teach this, I'm looking for concrete.
To your 2 year olds.
To 2 year olds, because my kids have never, they've only seen quantum leap on television and stuff like that.
Yeah, and that's not really a very good place to learn about quantum mechanics.
And with my kids, I can't begin here. They're not.
Yeah.
They're not even at the 10 year old stage. I'm sorry, my question's so basic.
Sure. So I don't pretend to really know the answer to that. The idea is, I've told you about this different kind of information, quantum information. And because it has different kinds of properties, as I'll maybe talk about a little in the remaining half hour, you can imagine building a computer that uses this kind of quantum information. And it's not necessarily true, but maybe someday we'll build these computers. And maybe they'll even be so common that everyone will have them in the home. And so what I would imagine is that would give a way of experiencing a quantum object more directly, is interacting with these quantum computers. And I don't know. I would start with kind of interference effects. That's in some level the simplest thing that you can still kind of concretely get a hold of. I didn't really tell you much, but you can imagine this kind of Rabi oscillation experiment. It's not so interesting, perhaps. But, to a kid, if you start to think about it more and try to understand what's going on, then it all of a sudden becomes more surprising. Little two-slit experiment, maybe, of you measure this slit. You've seen the two-slit experiment, I imagine? Yeah, it's a very common thing, so I figured. Where you measure this split and it's one probability distribution, you measure this one, it's another probability distribution. You don't measure either one and then you get a totally different one. That's not the sum of the two. That type of thing, I think, is something that is maybe the place to start. But again, I wouldn't do it just, as graphs, obviously, for a 2 year old. That's probably not a good place to do it. But some other, I like I said, I don't really know how to do this. The 10 year old is just really a hook to get this. Okay.
Is it fair to make the analogy to my students that the power of the block sphere is because we're really doing something with the circle, but you kind of use another dimension to give you more
well, so it's, I mean, the circle part is enough to get almost all the properties. The reason actually we need a third dimension is because of these complex numbers. That's the way it actually is in the real world. I mean, you can talk to the Quantum Foundations people here who might give you speculation as to why it's complex numbers rather than real numbers. But I'm much more practical. I could say, well, this is what we have. What are the consequences? I should maybe caution you that the block sphere is only good when you're talking about a single qubit. And if I ever get any further, I'll say a little bit about two qubits, where this picture doesn't work anymore. And just visualization breaks down, and unfortunately that's inevitable, because again, it's not something intuitive. Okay, yeah.
Suppose you have many photons, right? I have two questions. One is, in this lab, and I'm about to observe these photons. I just step up for a while, someone else came in and observed it, and he steps out, come back. I doesn't know that he has come in before, right?
Right.
So when I observe it, will it still be Has it been, would I know that it has been disturbed before? Or?
Well, so you wouldn't necessarily know. It depends on what you knew about it. So if you did, for instance, effectively this sequence of things, where you measured one basis, the duration basis, and you got an answer, and the other person came in and measured something different, the frequency, then you might come back and see that it's no longer short, right? So you could see then, by the fact that the state had been disturbed, that something had happened to it. On the other hand, you might just get lucky and randomly see short again, in which case you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know. So it's that you can probabilistically tell, but you can't definitively tell.
Then the other question I have is, if I have two photons, right, mm-hmm. I take one of them out to measure. If it happens to get back there, can it interfere with?
Sorry, say again. So you have two photons.
One of them has measured, right?
One of them is measured.
So its wave function has already collapsed or something like that. Then,
right.
But would it be able to affect?
So, yes and no. So first of all, what is the secret? Do these photons were prepared in the same state independently?
Yeah.
So in that case, no, there's no connection between them. Okay? So there's something else called an entangled state of these two photons. In that case, it still doesn't affect, but there's some kind of weird correlation. Yeah?
Yes, so why did you use this sphere as an analogy if you have only basically two types of information to look at? High or low, long or short, you could just end up using a plain circle.
Right, sure.
You can imply that you have something else that you have.
Well, okay. So I just really it's the other way around, which is the sphere is the right thing, and what I was describing was a simplification. So really, to describe a qubit, you need to think of three properties. The properties of the three axes here, the x-axis, the y-axis, and z-axis. If you have the probabilities along all three of those, then that's actually enough information to completely reconstruct this quantum state. Whereas if you just have two of them, it's not enough. There's still some phase information that's missing. So the real thing, the real quantum mechanical object, really does have the sphere and has a three-dimensional. But you can see most of the properties just by looking at the two-dimensional duration and frequency. Okay? So maybe I should talk about this two-qubit case and these entangled states.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I know I frightened you by saying I was going to do something more advanced, but okay, it's time for that. So okay, two qubits. So with two qubits, of course, you can just treat them independently. That's one possibility, where one of them has one quantum state, alpha 0 plus beta 1, and the other one has a totally separate quantum state, alpha prime 0 plus beta prime 1. Okay? But they can also be correlated in some way, and they can be what's called entangled states. So an entangled state, you really can't treat them separately. So for instance, for a single qubit, I said, well, it's not possible to know both the duration and the frequency. In fact, it's not even well-defined. State doesn't have both a well-defined duration and a well-defined frequency. But for two qubits, you can have states that have the following property, that so neither has well-defined frequency or duration. And what I mean by that is if you just measure either one of them, you'll get 50% high-low, 50% short-long. But both have the same frequency and the same duration. And when I say and, I really mean and. So if you measure the frequency of both of these, you'll either get both high or both low. And which one you get will be random, but they'll always be the same. And similarly, if you measure the duration of these same two qubits, you'll either get both long or both short. It'll be random with one, but they'll both be the same. Okay? This is an entangled state. Yeah. And this specific one is sometimes called an EPR pair. So sometimes it's used for the singlet. But of course, there's lots of other entangled states. And you can have different kinds of amplitudes of, well, there's all possible combinations of 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. You can have any superposition of those four things with the normalization. Yeah?
When they are entangled, it's either or. Neither has that well-defined frequency or duration or both. Or are you just saying
no. We have both of these properties at the same time. Okay, so with these two photons, if you measure any single one of them in frequency, you'll get a random result. Same if you measure any single one of them in duration. But if you measure both frequency on both of them, you'll always get the same answer. It'll be random, but it'll be the same.
Schizophrenic identical twins.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of.
And I'm preparing a stream of entangled states.
Yeah.
And I'm measuring them. And the first test I do is measure the duration. And every time I measure the duration, it's short. Then I know it's not entangled.
That's right.
Because so, it has to have an ill-defined duration to be entangled.
That's correct, yes. Okay. So, so maybe now's the time to get back to this terminology about pure states versus mixed states. So the pure states are the things of the form I wrote up there, alpha 0 plus beta 1. And if you make the right measurement for those, it might be in some weird angle. But if you make the right measurement, you'll always get a definite value. Okay? But for some other states, you don't get a definite value for any measurement you make. I mean, unless the measurement is defined as, well, I always get the answer 0. But it's too high. The point is, if you have a point on the surface of that block sphere, there's some axis you can get where it's the pole of that axis. Whereas if you have a point in the middle, that's what's called a mixed state. And that way, there's always some fundamental randomness in the measurements you make, no matter what axis you're measuring along. Okay? And for these entangled states, if you just take one of the two qubits out of this entangled state, it by itself is in a mixed state. Any measurement you make will give you a random result. In this particular case, it's completely random. But if you take both together, they're now again in a pure state. And there's measurements you can make that will give you definite results. In particular, if you make a measurement that says, do they have the same frequency or a different frequency? That has a definite answer. The answer is always the same. And if do they have the same duration or opposite duration? That answer is always the same. Yeah.
So if, say, I measure one, the frequency of one and the duration of the other, can I then measure the frequency of the second one and get the same as the frequency of the other one? Or by the fact that I measured the duration, I've now disentangled?
Well, yeah, basically.
I've disentangled.
Yeah. So once you measure the duration of one of them, well, you know the duration of the other. And so the other as basically collapses, we say, into a state that's the same as the one you measured. So you measure the long duration. The other one is now the long duration state. And if you were to measure it in a different state, well, then you're back to this situation again, of a single qubit being measured in different bases.
You take out measuring one, definitely, or the other, so you don't have to measure.
Right. So this is kind of what I was saying. When you have the entangled states, measuring one of them, some people like to say it influences the other one because it collapses into this other quantum state. But the reality is, not really influencing, because there's no way to send any kind of signal this way, because what you're getting is random. Yeah?
This is kind of a summary. So what you're telling us, we could take classical information, put it into quantum information, and nobody's going to copy it?
No. Okay, that's actually a very good question. The problem is that the classical information still has this property that can be copied. So you could put classical information into quantum information by saying, well, if I want to store a 0, I'll do it as the north pole of this block sphere. If I want to do a 1, I'll do it as the south pole of the block sphere. Yeah, that's the way I did it. Uh-huh. But the problem is that then you could still copy it, because then it's just in a single basis. By measuring in that basis, you can extract this one classical bit of information and copy that. It's only the superposition part that you can't copy.
So if we changed it to quantum information that involves superpositioning,
yeah.
And that's when the information becomes uncopyable.
That's right.
And that's what the music industry hasn't learned yet?
That's right. That's correct, yes.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah.
Is the significance of this entangled state in that we can compare two qubits of information and to say, yes, they're in the same conditions, or no, not the same conditions? Is it only the same significance in this yes or no final? We have two types of descriptors only?
Well, so there's now four types of descriptors, right? Because they could have the same or opposite frequency and the same or opposite duration.
Yeah.
Well, this is where I started.
Ignoring the kind of different combinations, and we can say yes, they're the same, no, they're different.
Yeah. So what the thing is that by making the right measurements here, which is a collective measurement of both qubits together, you can get out some definite information. Whereas if you just looked at a single one of them, it would be random. And so there's lots of other interesting properties of entangled states. So getting the same frequency is kind of not very interesting from a classical point of view. You could flip a coin and then make another coin that was the same as it. Just, you know, look at the first one and set it up so that they're the same. And then when you reveal the first coin, well, the second coin will always be the same, even though what it is random. Right?
Yeah.
So just having the same frequency, that's not so surprising. And the same duration similarly. I mean, you could imagine maybe there's some classical description behind it. Now, we know there's not, of course, because we've thought about the single qubit case where we don't have a well-defined frequency or well-defined duration. But actually, there's an even stronger thing you can do. If you make measurements along different bases, I don't want to get into this because it's more involved, but I should at least mention it, which is you can find correlations that couldn't possibly be described by having some classical information. Sorry, wrong. You have the two qubits. You have some classical information here that says, oh, if I measure frequency, I'll get this result. If I measure duration, I'll get this result. And you could imagine setting up classical variables that would say, well, it's always random here, but together they're always the same. But there's other tests you can make where this can't possibly be explained that way. You get correlations between these two qubits that are stronger than you could get from any classical underlying hidden variable description. Unless there was some way of signaling back and forth between these particles. So that's called quantum non-locality. And like I said, I don't really want to get into that. But it's also considered a signature property of quantum. Yeah?
I've been struggling with trying to teach quantum computing to my students. I haven't done it yet because I don't feel like I've got it. Once you have two qubits for quantum computing, you have to deal with entanglement, is that right?
Yes, you have to consider entanglement.
Okay, so there's no way we're going to be able to do entanglement itself is a whole interesting kettle of fish. Okay, so that's necessary. Okay.
Yeah.
You kind of briefly alluded to how to describe a mixed state in relation to a block sphere, but I didn't catch it. How do I designate?
So the points on the inside, on the surface of the block sphere are the pure states, where they have a definite value for some measurement. The points on the inside are the mixed states.
You mean like interior, like closer to the mm-hmm.
closer to the margin,
sphere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. And the thing is that they have more randomness, right? That on the surface there's a trade-off of randomness between the different axes that you might measure. And you're not getting close to that trade-off when you're further in. There's just more randomness because you're further away from any pole, basically. Well, kind of. Not necessarily true, but there is more randomness. Yeah.
And then what is the origin?
The origin is the completely mixed state where any measurement you make is totally random, no matter what axis. Yeah, so going to the center is more random. On surface, less random. Although, again, there can still be randomness if you measure in the wrong basis. The probability comes closer to half of any result. Okay, so maybe then I'll just finish. Well, yeah, okay. So let me say a word or two about quantum computing, and then I'll tell you about quantum teleportation as a grand finale. So nowadays people are actually starting to be able to make qubits, and you'll see that this afternoon, I guess, at IPC. But the idea is that because of this entanglement and superpositions and interference and these other weird quantum effects, we can do things with quantum information, manipulate them in ways that you can't do with classical bits and classical information. And so the idea is if you could build a computer out of qubits, a quantum computer, you could solve some problems much, much faster because you could run new algorithms, run a new series of processes that intrinsically use interference, for instance, to do things that classical computers don't have available. And there's some problems that you can solve much, much faster using a quantum computer. The most famous and perhaps one of the most important, certainly one of the most important, is called Shor's algorithm, which is used for factoring very large numbers. So you have a number that's a product of two big primes. Well, it's easy to multiply those primes together to get the big number. But it's very hard to go the other way. Trying all the primes smaller than number, that takes much too long. There's much, much better ways to do that, but it's still very hard. And a quantum computer can do it pretty fast. And this is important practically because there are a number of quantum, classical cryptographic systems, which are based on factoring being a hard problem. In particular, the idea of RSA, the system RSA, which is very widely used in the internet and elsewhere for encryption, is only secure if you can't factor large numbers efficiently. So if someone were to build a quantum computer, RSA would become insecure. So as you can imagine, the NSA is very interested in this and funding a lot of research in the US and similarly in other countries. But it's not just about factoring. The factoring algorithm was maybe the first one that gave us an indication that there were some lots, potentially lots, we don't have a lot now, we have only a few, but of interesting quantum algorithms that can solve some interesting problems much faster than any classical computer could. Okay? So then let's finish up with quantum teleportation. So despite the name, it's not really about moving around big objects. Remember, this is something about quantum information. And remember that since we can't copy quantum information, well, that sets some kind of limits on how we can process it. So if you had a classical bit and you want to move it somewhere else, well, you just look at it and you send it over a telephone line. Now, you could make a quantum telephone line, an optical fiber that can carry a photon. And that works pretty well. But there's another way, and that involves quantum teleportation.
Pretend neurons,
that's right. Okay. So we have Alice over here. Alice is the room downstairs. And we're here in Bonn. And Alice has a qubit that she wants to send to Bonn. Okay? Now, one thing she could do is she could take this qubit and, you know, protect it very well and then get in the elevator, go down a floor and give it to Bob. Oh, sorry, Alice is downstairs. Go up a floor and give it to us here at Bob. But again, we don't want to do that. We want to do something that maybe doesn't involve getting in the elevator again. But to start with, Alice and Bob, they set up some particular situation. They set up an entangled state, one of these EPR pairs. This thing. Okay? So they have some kind of quantum resource that's shared between them, the two qubits of this entangled state. And the question is, can they use that to send this qubit without having to get in the elevator? And they can. And the way to do that is Alice is going to make a measurement on her qubit and EPR pair. She's not going to measure them separately. She's going to measure them together in a collective way, do something called a Bell measure. So the Bell measurement has four possible outcomes. It's getting two classical bits of information. So using the terminology I've said before, they ask two questions. So the first one is, this is something you do on two qubits. So the two qubits have the same or opposite frequency. Okay? The second question is, do they have the same or opposite duration? Okay? And even though asking just the frequency of one of them and the duration of one of them, those are incompatible questions, these two questions are compatible, and you can ask them both at once. And in fact, there are states that have a definite value for both of these questions. Okay, like the EPR pair. Okay? But we're not asking this about the EPR pair. We're asking about this about the qubit that Alice wants to send. And Alice's qubit from the EPR pair. So it's a different pair of qubits. Okay? And that's important. Better keep that up. Use this board here. So this Bell measurement, Alice has one qubit from the EPR pair, and she has the qubit that she wants to send. And so she's making the Bell measurement on those two qubits. Then Bob has the other qubit from the EPR pair. So this is Bob down. Yellow is not so hard. Anyway, Bob is down here.
Strong request. Could you make a little picture of each qubit you're talking about? Qubit A, qubit B, qubit C.
Okay. Does that help? Okay. So the qubits go along these lines. Imagine this is kind of a world line diagram, but it's going to the right. Okay? Okay. So Alice is going to take the answers to these two questions from the Bell measurement and send them to Bob. So she just picks up the phone. There's one somewhere, I think. Maybe in there. Bob is downstairs. Alice is downstairs. We're in Bob. And so Alice downstairs picks up the phone, calls us up here in Bob, and says, I got the answers same frequency and opposite duration, or whatever she gets. Okay? So there's two classical bits of information that we learned. And based on that, up here in Bob, we have to do something to our qubit to reconstruct Alice's original qubit. So how do we do that? Well, let's think about this. So we know that the two qubits of the EPR pair. So first, let's try to reconstruct the frequency. The two qubits of the EPR pair are the same in frequency, right? And suppose Alice tells us that hers versus the EPR pair also have the same frequency. Okay? If you got the same answer, the answer yes or the same to this question one. Okay? Well, what does that tell us? Well, if hers is the same one as the EPR pair, her qubit of the EPR pair, and the qubit from the EPR pair, Alice's qubit, has the same frequency as ours, well, then it should be that, I can use different headlines. So A and B are going to be the names of these two qubits in the EPR pair, okay? And so we know from the start that A and B are in the EPR pair, so they are the same. And Alice measured the one sending an A. And so we know that the one she's sending is the same as A, and A is the same as B, so hers should be the same as B, okay? So we'll leave its frequency alone. On the other hand, suppose she got the opposite frequency. Well, then we could say, well, hers is opposite from A, and A is the same as B, so hers could also be opposite from B. So we know that the qubit that we have, in order to get it to right frequency, we should flip its frequency. Instead of high, we should change it to low. We don't know what it was. We don't know whether it's high or low. But whatever we're doing, we're switching the two. Okay? And for duration, we do the same thing. If hers, her qubit is the same as qubit A in duration, well, ours is the same again, so it should be the same as hers. And if it was opposite, then it should be opposite. Okay, so we might have to flip the duration as well. Yeah?
So you're saying that we now know how to manipulate our qubit to make it the same as her qubit.
Yeah.
But only because of her phone call telling us
that's right. That's right. So the upshot is that after doing this for the frequency and duration, the qubit we have is exactly the same as hers. And if somebody later came along and told us what her qubit was and what measurement we should make to get a definite answer, we can measure it and we get that definite answer, even if it's neither of these two properties, right? Even if it's some other angle along the box here. Okay? So we've exactly reconstructed this continuous information about the amplitudes, alpha and beta. Even though all we measured and sent were these two classical bits, even though the state couldn't be copied, we've kind of disassembled it and reassembled it somewhere else. Another thing you can think of this as doing is that we want to transport quantum information from Alice to Bob. And we've done it by breaking down into a quantum part that comes from this EPR pair, which gets used up in the process, and an information part, which is the classical bits that Alice has to send to Bob. Yeah?
Why do you call it teleportation? You still use the phone line to basically transfer this information. So it's not teleportation. There's still a channel of information that takes.
Right. So you definitely need an information channel to do this. But the thing is that this quantum object, because it can't be copied, you can imagine it being sent from place A to place B. And the quantum object is not sent through the phone line, because you're only sending these two classical bits, which is not enough to describe the quantum bit. Yeah, well, it's quantum teleportation. Yeah. So you're teleporting quantum objects. Yeah.
I must have missed something somewhere, I think.
How? I don't see how that could possibly
be. But measuring the frequency for say, qubit A.
Yeah.
That doesn't destroy the entanglement in duration between A and B.
Yes and no. So what happens is you have to look at the collective quantum state of all three particles. So if you want to write this down mathematically, you look at the collective quantum state of all three particles. And this Bell measurement does kind of collapse the system, but it collapses the global system. And it does it in such a way that this state B collapses to some rotation of this original qubit. And the rotation, well, it depends on the outcome of these two classical bits. It'll be a rotation that's flipped in either the frequency direction or the duration direction or both, or neither, it could be. And each of those four outcomes is equally likely, as it turns out.
But you could measure the frequency of the two bits that you have and then measure the duration of the two bits that you have.
Sorry, that Alice could measure.
Yes, Alice could do.
Well, she can do both of those. She can measure whether the same or different in both things at the same time. She actually gets measured the frequency of these two things. That would destroy the entanglement, and it would also destroy her qubit, and it wouldn't work at all. Okay, and then it would be too late to measure the duration. You lose that information.
Because you either get the same or different, but you don't know exactly.
You don't know which one it was. That's right. In fact, it's not even well defined which one it was necessarily. Yeah.
Bob can only reduce the state of the qubit, but he doesn't have the qubit.
He doesn't know what the state of the qubit is, but he has the qubit that has that state.
Also, the qubit B now has the same information as that.
Yeah, so I guess I can finish the picture. So here he flips things back, and then the thing that comes out here is Alice's qubit, original qubit, intact, exactly the same state.
Can you join us for lunch?
Sure.
Okay. I'm afraid we have to draw an end to this because we are on a really strict timeline for the afternoon with ITC. And so you understand those people over there. They're like me. They have actually got experimental things they could hurt us with. So, I'd like to thank.
Okay.